Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, along with Mel, K2KEY. At this time, we begin the sick net. By now, you guys know, your purpose is to discuss subjects of ham radio and the things that are a little bit harder to understand. And there's quite a bit to ham radio. 26 different kinds of hobbies all wrapped together into one common denominator, wireless. And so people come here, and with the help of our friends, we find out how to make our transmitters and antennas, feed lines, and modes of propagation, methods of modulation, and computer interfacing, how to make all of that work better, or how to understand it. That's the major purpose of the TechNet. The subjects that are discussed in general are the subjects that you bring as questions. Occasionally, Mel will have a presentation on something like this chart, but in general, the majority of the subjects that are discussed are the ones that are on your mind. So a person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. And if we have very few people checking in, you can check in and say no. But most of the time, that's not required. So, at this time, please give me your call letters and name. And that yes, KQRIW, listening.
W2EWK, listening. It's reporting the net.
Eugene recognized. Anyone else?
W2TT Gordon. No, and good evening, Dick.
Glad to hear from you, Gordon. Gordon is the man who runs a TechNet on Thursday night in New Jersey. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call with a name at this time.
WV2U, Paul with a yes.
KT2MDP, Steve, no question.
QRUA, Steve, no question.
Okay, so we've got Paul with a yes, Steve with a no. Who is the next person?
KT2RUA, Steve with a no.
Okay, Steve's number two with a no. Anyone else?
I'll say good evening. This is KT2KEY.
And was that with a yes? That was a joke. Anyone else to check in? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
KT2OJO, Howard, yes.
Glad to hear from you, Howard. Anyone else?
KT2J, Dave, no.
Very fine, Dave. Okay, the first person with a yes was Paul, Whiskey Victor 2 Uniform. What would you like to talk about tonight, Paul? You've got the floor. Whiskey Victor 2 Uniform, Paul, are you there? Okay, maybe he got called away. The next person who signed in with a yes was Howard, KC2 Oscar Juliet Oscar, I think it is. Go right ahead, Howard.
Hi, I'm a relatively new fan, and I have just set up a shack on the second floor of my house, which is a colonial. And if all of the different variations of these adults and relatives. Now, so far, I've been working with I could not reach your computer over the last month or so. I did just finish putting up on the top of my chimney, an 8-foot mast and a diamond. I believe it's in SF-30 antenna. And of course, now I reach out quite a bit better than the cable. From the base of the antenna right at the base of the pole. I ran an inch and a half copper plate. Both are connected to the electrical service. Now, what's kind of disturbing is what I heard, that if you're going to work from the second floor, you're not going to do well on all bands. If you're grounding, it's going to be sensitive. Different wavelengths. It'll be a quarter wavelength, a half wavelength, or something in between. So what are you supposed to do?
Good set of questions there, Howard. Howard, before I proceed, let me know that I'm hearing you both on the input and the output. You've got a good, strong radio signal, but your audio is quite low. It almost sounds like you're talking into the back of the microphone. I think you're not. So either you're quite far from the mic or speaking very softly, or the audio on your rig is set a little bit low. So do walk closer to the mic and eat the mic, so to speak. Talk a little bit louder. Because, as I said, your audio was quite low. The subject of grounding is a darn interesting one. There are three different kinds of grounds, at least, that I can speak of. Number one reason that you ground your equipment is for human safety. In other words, almost every modern-day piece of equipment has not a two-prong wall connector, but a three-prong wall connector. Oh, 30 years ago, many appliances only had two prongs. The third prong is the so-called neutral, and it's connected with the wiring of your house, back to the fuse panel, back to whatever is considered the house ground, usually the wiring, the plumbing of the house, if it's got copper plumbing or steel pipe plumbing, lead pipe plumbing, and or separate ground rod. So the main reason for grounding is human safety, because back in the days when we used to have only a two-prong connector on our appliances, there was a slim possibility that the 110-volt line, the so-called hot lead, the black wire, if it came in contact with the chassis, and the chassis therefore became hot, and you touched the chassis with one hand and touched something that's grounded like a radiator or a sink faucet with the other hand, the 120 volts would be across your body, and it could do you some pretty great harm. By way of that neutral wire, the third prong, which ensures that the chassis itself of the appliance is grounded, a tremendous amount of safety improvement took place. The second reason we do grounding is for lightning protection. If you and I were living on the top of a mountain, and if our tower was the tallest thing around, without a doubt, the chances of it being struck would be reasonably high, probably once per year at least. If you're on the tallest local mountain with a metal antenna sticking up above the trees on that mountain, you're going to be struck. And if the grounding system is sufficient, then the majority of the lightning energy is conducted into Earth as opposed to being conducted through your electronics, where it could do damage, and maybe even through you if you're touching the electronics at the time that the lightning bolt occurs. Now, grounding for lightning reasons is darn important. However, again, highly misunderstood.
Repeater, time out, cancel.
The average amateur does not live on top of a mountain. The average amateur, he is not the tallest thing around. There are utility poles and buildings and trees and all kinds of things that are taller. The average amateur's equipment probably isn't struck even once in a lifetime, maybe only once in five lifetimes on average. So amateurs have looked at their electronics, they've looked at that piece of wire they put in the air. Mentally, they somehow get the impression that it is a huge attractor for all these electrons of a lightning bolt that just want to find that piece of metal and hit their piece of electronics. Lightning striking your particular equipment is extremely rare. But even with extremely good grounding, you will drastically protect your house from the possibility of fire. Lightning striking some object that's in contact with your house could very easily flow through your house and create a fire in the house. So there have been lightning-created fires in private homes, and good grounding can definitely decrease that. However, you have to admit to yourself that the total energy of a lightning bolt when it occurs is so huge that even with proper grounding, there is a chance that your electronics, the low noise front end, first amplifier of your radio, could be damaged. And so even if the grounding was perfect, damage could occur to the electronics. It makes a huge improvement, proper grounding, but it never makes perfect isolation from all possible lightning damage. The third reason that we do grounding is to make our antennas work better. And there's a big catch here. If your antenna is a thoroughly balanced antenna, like a dipole, radio-wise, absolutely no grounding is required. When your transmission line is feeding power through the right kind of a balancing device into a thoroughly symmetric dipole, at one instant in time, your transmitter through that feed line, through the transmission line, is launching some electrons into the right-hand side of the dipole. At the exact same instant, it is subtracting some electrons out of the left-hand side of the dipole. It's a thoroughly balanced situation. The transmission line makes the situation act as if your transmitter was located right at the center of the dipole, and the transmitter is a kind of electron pump. It is subtracting electrons from one place, we usually call that the counterpoise, and it's pushing them into the other place, we usually call that the antenna. Well, in the case of a thoroughly symmetric antenna, like a dipole, the counterpoise and the antenna are one and the same, and they look the same. So a dipole is part of your Yagi antenna.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A dipole that you set up on 160, 80, 40, 20, 15, 17, 10 meters, any kind of a dipole like that, thoroughly symmetrical, requires no grounding radio-wise. There are people who think that if they ground the rig and ground something near the antenna, that radio-wise the antenna will behave better. Most of the time, that's not true. Now, there are a couple of exceptions here. If I didn't use a balancing device at the connection between transmission line and antenna, and if my transmission line was a coax cable, which by definition is a kind of unbalanced transmission line. In other words, inside of the coax cable, you're putting voltage on the semiconductor, and the return is the inner surface of the outer conductor. That's where the current flows. You could say the current flows out on the semiconductor and comes back on the inside surface of the outer conductor of the transmission line. And if you have the right kind of a balancing device, that's exactly the way it works. If you skip the balancing device by just taking the shield of the coax and connect it to one half of the dipole and the center of the coax and connect it to the other half of the dipole, the whole system works. But it develops a couple of peculiar characteristics. While you're launching voltage into the right side and the left side of the dipole, some of that voltage on the left side will now crawl down the outside of your transmission line, the outside of your coax, and now the coax becomes radio-wise part of the antenna. This is not a disaster, but it's just a complicating factor which could give you some grief. If that transmission line happens to be running up the side of your apartment building and it runs near the neighbor's television set, the fact that there's RF energy flowing down the outside of your coax cable could create some excess television interference. And there are people in that situation who do or don't ground the transmission line at the shack end, and sometimes they see some improvement, sometimes they do not. Had they used the right kind of a balancing device right at the antenna, that problem would go away. And the balancing device doesn't have to be expensive. A poor man's balance consists of nothing more, let me drop, nothing more than a few turns of the coax cable as a coil held together with black electrical tape. That becomes a kind of an RF choke where RF energy no longer has the ability to flow down that coax cable on the outside. And so that's a poor man's balance. You can go out and buy a real device called balance, and it's a tubular device, usually about 2 inches in diameter, probably around 8 or 10 inches long. It costs a few dollars. It mechanically is very convenient because it's got a hook on it where you can hang it from a tree or from the top of your tower. And it's got two rings on the side where you can connect the two halves of your dipole. And it's got a a UHF connector on the bottom usually. So it's a convenient mechanical device that does act as an RF choke, as a balance. Now the fact that you're on the second floor of a building does not make things better or worse. In my opinion, you don't have any great advantage if you're operating from the basement. There are people who think you do. But as you're about to see confirmed, and you've already saw it yourself, on VHF frequencies, altitude makes a huge difference. At VHF frequencies, 6 meters and above, trees and the leaves on the trees and the branches and the trunk of the tree are pretty good RF absorbers, radio frequency absorbers, radio frequency shielding devices. If your antenna is below the tree line on your particular property, and if you're not the tallest house around, so to speak, on the highest piece of land, therefore that radio wave has got to go through maybe a quarter of a mile or a couple of miles of trees before it finally gets out into free space, you're going to see an awful lot of loss. Particularly in the summertime, when there's water on the leaves after a rainy day, you're going to see an awful lot of loss. When I used to talk to guys on 432, and I used to keep accurate signal strength readings, I could tell right away the guy whose antenna was higher than the trees. His signal strength would be about the same summer, winter, spring, and fall. On a dry day or a rainy day, the signal was the same. A guy whose antenna was 20 feet, 40 feet below the tops of the trees, he would be weaker in the summertime when there's leaves on the trees. He would be weaker still after a rain took place and the leaves were wet. So VHF, altitude makes a big difference. The fact that you raise your antenna to a higher altitude and maybe change the antenna makes a huge improvement. But being on the second floor isn't a disadvantage. VHF-wise, it's an advantage because good antennas don't require ground to work well unless you're one of these very unlucky guys as far as the geography of where you live. Lightning is nowhere near as much of a problem as you think. Since you're higher up above the ground, your feed line to the antenna is a shorter length of line. Therefore, you don't have to...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Therefore, you don't have to spend as many dollars buying a really low-loss feed line because you're not using as much of it. A person who's operating from the top of the Empire State Building, if he could afford it, would be a hell of a lot better off radio-wise than the guy who's working it from the basement of his home, so to speak. So be happy about the fact you've got the altitude. It's not a disadvantage. So there's a little more to the story than you've heard so far, but maybe the beginning information is going to help. Back to you, Howard, and do talk a little bit louder into your mic. KC2, Oscar Juliet Oscar. Welcome to Ham Radio, K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. By the way, it's very, very good news that the signal is fairly strong, both directions through the repeater, of course. About a month or so, maybe 5 weeks ago, I tried to enter the TechNet. I was not successful because my signal was too weak using the same little Kenwood handheld, but it was using its own from the second floor, but a little longer than little rubber ducky antenna. And now I am going to about 25 feet from RG58 to the antenna, which I believe is probably about 30 feet above ground level. I think the trees might be a bit higher, about 30, 40 feet away, but not too much higher. Now, the reason I put the 1.5-inch copper tape all the way from the mast down to the ground rod, I guess basically I was primarily concerned about lightning and the trees not appearing to be that much higher than the antenna I was putting up. But the grounding is going to be very interesting for another reason. I purchased some interesting half-wave dipoles that are not center-fed. They're end-fed. As an example, I have a 66-foot long, which is half-wave at 40 meters. A company called Par Electronics makes a small matching device at the end of that antenna. You run the coax up to the end of the antenna. You're feeding a very high impedance, probably a few thousand ohms, but it still is a dipole even though it's just a single long wire, though I assume have high voltage at both ends. One of the interesting things they say is to avoid RF in the shaft. Don't ground the end of the antenna at your shaft, ground it outside. I assume that's probably true, but I haven't put the end. It will be fastened to the mast and then to a tree. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Howard. Great you told me that. When you end feed an antenna, and if the antenna itself is a half wave, various guys have done it by way of a helically wound, electronically half wave long antenna, and they use as a counterpoise the railing of the balcony at their apartment on, say, the fifth floor of a building, and it works extremely well. Due to the fact that when you feed the end of a half wave long antenna, and the impedance is a few thousand ohms, the magnitude of the counterpoise required, the grounding system becomes extremely light. In other words, very little grounding is required. There's something called an end-fed depth antenna that people have built in the past, where the end of the coax cable, the shield goes nowhere, and that becomes the counterpoise. The center conductor goes to the end-fed antenna. You're feeding a very high impedance point, and you can get away with that. In the case of a quarter-wave ground plane antenna, an antenna that I don't have a great deal of love for, but quite a few people love these ground plane antennas where the radiator is electronically a quarter wave long, they mount it on the lawn in the backyard, and you have to lay down some ground plane radials. And for that antenna to work well, it takes a very large number of ground plane radials so that they're not heating up the earth as a dummy load, so to speak. So a full half wave antenna, vertically or horizontally polarized, is a far superior antenna, whether you feed it in the center or the end. I'm strongly in favor of half-wave antennas over quarter-wave antennas. A rubber duck antenna works quite well. Believe it or not, it's got a gain that's probably not very far from a dipole, and it has an efficiency that's quite high. If you measure the efficiency of a modern-day rubber duck antenna, you'd probably find it's 95% or better. The problem with the rubber duck is that it's usually located quite low down in altitude. Let me drop. And that's the major problem, the fact that it's low down in altitude. Did I get a complete reset? Let me think. Okay. The beep I heard before was quite low in amplitude there. So, because it's low down in amplitude, because you, the human being, are very close to it, and you, the human being, is something made out of 90-some-odd% water, and water at VHF frequencies is very absorptive. A human being makes a very good dummy load to VHF frequencies. There's a pun there somewhere. So the human being standing near the antenna of the rubber duck, and the rubber duck not having very much altitude and not having a clear line of sight most of the time, means that its performance is kind of marginal. If you and your buddy were both using handy talkies and the rubber duck antenna, and you just started walking away from each other, you would have medium good propagation up to about a mile of distance between the two. And depending on the terrain, beyond a mile, the reception and transmission would be a little bit marginal, unless one of you is standing on top of a very tall hill or a very tall mountain. That exact same rubber duck antenna on the ground that gives you about a mile of reliable communication, when one of those rubber duck antennas was being held by, and a slight modification of a rubber duck antenna, was being held by astronaut Owen Garriott on the space shuttle back in 1985, I personally talked to him, so to speak, while he was over northern Texas, 1,500 miles away. He just happened to be 140 nautical miles in the air with direct line of sight, that exact same antenna. So as you can tell, what makes an antenna work well, you've heard me say it many times, is three things. All three of them are location. It really means altitude. Altitude, altitude, altitude. You put the antenna in the right place, and you're going to get very good transmission and reception. One of the questions that Mel and I are frequently asked on the TechNet is, should I buy this fancy $500 antenna with these gold-plated doodads on it and coils and inductors and capacitive top hat and whatever? Should I buy this expensive antenna and mount it near the ground? Or should I build an antenna out of coat hanger wire and mount it high in the air? The answer is always the second one. The cheap antenna mounted high altitude on VHF is going to behave a hell of a lot better. Now, in the case of HF antennas, 80 through 10 meters, slightly different things occur. The trees are nowhere near as absorptive down there. A dipole that's below tree line on 8 meters can do extremely well. A 2-meter antenna below tree line will not be quite as good as it could be if you can raise it a little bit more. But the grounding, as you've already discovered, in the case of an end-fed antenna, where the impedance is very high, almost no grounding is required. If you eliminated that piece of 1.5-inch wide copper tape all the way to the ground and had nothing but the feed line going there, my guess is your performance would... My guess is your performance would be within about a half a dB of where it is within the cup, where it is with the copper tape. The copper tape itself is doing a little bit of radiating. You're launching a little bit of current into it, and it's doing a little bit of radiating. But because it's much lower to the ground, the effectiveness you're getting out of the copper tape is marginal. Now, antennas and grounding is a peculiar subject. RF ground is, in many cases, the chassis of the electronics. When you're using your handy-talkie and you're transmitting to the rubber duck, where is ground? Ground is the metal case inside of the plastic housing of that rubber duck antenna. The handy-talkie itself is the ground. On top of that, the human hand wrapped around the handy-talkie means that your hand and your arm is part of the grounding of that system. That's part of the counterpoise. If you did a computer animation with high-frequency structure simulator program of a rubber duck operating on a handy-talkie radio in the hand of a human being, you would find out that 90-some-odd percent of the energy is coming out of the rubber duck. The other 10% is coming out of the hand and the arm of the person that's holding it. And if he's holding it real close to his chest, maybe even a little bit of the energy is being radiated by his shoulder, if you know what I mean. So the word ground is peculiar, and to a person just cutting his teeth in electronics, so to speak, it becomes a difficult thing to explain, define, understand, and so on. You'll become more familiar with this as you talk to your fellow amateurs and as you do your own experiments to find out what works well and what doesn't work well. By the way, your audio was quite a bit louder last time. I could tell you're talking closer to the mic, and you sound quite a bit better, Howard. A KC2OJO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I think I can understand that somewhat better. And really the only issue, I have not yet put up the 40-meter long dipole that will be end-fed. And I guess the only issue in my mind, really, is whether I'm sending coax up to my mast, then I come to the little box, because basically it must have some type of resonant transformer, except at 50 ohms, up to a few thousand ohms, best it can, and I have the long wire. Now, I can either let my coax be grounded back where it normally is, because it's attached to the radio there, or I can also add a ground all the way up at the little matching box and send that to the copper tape and the mast. And I really don't know whether I should ground it at the mast also, or just leave them ground at the shack. Although the electronics says best to ground it at the mast of the next. Over to you,
Dick. I'm in agreement with those instructions, Howard. When you ground that black box, the little box, which is stepping up 50 ohms to a few thousand ohms, and you ground it to the mast, in my opinion, most of the time, you get slightly better performance. However, I think it would be a very interesting experiment to put a relay there, a remotely controlled relay, which either does or doesn't ground it to the mast, or does or doesn't ground it to your copper tape going to the ground, and find out what the difference in performance is. It will be a slightly different configuration of the antenna, which will change the pattern slightly. And so if you're talking to a person to the north of you, in one case it's going to work better grounded, and if you're talking to the person to the east of you, in another case it might work better ungrounded. So the word ground, as you can tell, RF-wise, is a very relative thing. And is it better or worse? I think 60% of the time it's better, but not all the time. Let me ask your Mel, who's done an awful lot of antenna experimenting with his buddies from the Kings County Radio Club. Mel, I wonder if you've ever used very many N-fed antennas, N-fed ZEPs, half-wave dipoles that are N-fed, with and without grounding. I wonder if you've had some experience in this area, and if so, what have you found in your studies? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening again. This is K2KEY. Yes, one of the antennas that really comes to mind, which I found really good, especially for a use on 160 meters, was the inverted L, which actually is an inverted L, and it's fed on the end using just a basically a simple L network. And it was quite effective. Or another antenna also fed on the end, also for situations where people have limited space, especially they want to get on either 80 or 160, is the what they call the lazy U, which is basically a flat top, drops down whatever convenient height you can drop it from, wherever high you can get it up, and then it can travel along like a fence or whatever another distance, and then set up whatever end where the end has to show up. Again, using the L network, simple way of managing, and then going from the L network would usually say find that yeah, you can ground the shield of the coax either way on either end, but basically it's more of a convenience. And a number of the guys that I've talked to, let me drop. A number of the guys I used to talk to, what they had is a little simple motor device that they would put on the variable condenser in the L network box, and be able to go across the band with it with very good results. N-fed antennas, Marconi long wires, and all kinds of situations still have a good place in ham radio, Dick. Over.
Glad to hear that. Yeah, I've used a few N-fed antennas. I've used a lot more center-fed antennas. Since the antenna material itself is not very expensive, Howard, you might also want to try an inverted V center-fed dipole. In the case of a center-fed dipole, everything being symmetric, the word ground is no longer required in any way other than lightning protection if you really, really think you need it. But with the right kind of a fouling device or even a homebrew balance, center-feeding the antenna at your mast and drooping it down on each side as an inverted V is another very convenient antenna. What would might be an awful lot of fun for you to do is to continue using your N-fed antenna with or without the grounding to with the tape or with to the mast, and to also put at right angles. Like, in other words, if the current antenna is going east-west, you could have a lot of fun putting a center-fed inverted V north and south, maybe fed with another piece of coax cable or maybe fed with a remotely controlled relay so you can flip back between the two. I would prefer to feed it with a second piece of coax cable for two reasons. One, reliability, and then you can do some electronic games that are an awful lot of fun. You can use a power divider and feed power to both the N-fed antenna with one piece of cable and feed the other half of the power to the inverted V antenna with the other piece of cable. And as you shift the phase angle or amplitude of the signal that you send to those two cables, to those two antennas, you are electronically steering the pattern. And so depending on where the DX station you want to talk to is, and depending on where the QR Mary is coming from, the interference from other strong stations, electronically steering your antenna can be a lot of fun. You might be able to steer it in a direction that nulls out the QR Mary, but emphasizes the signal you want to talk to. So, antennas are a great place where we all do a lot of experimenting. They tend not to be too expensive if you know how to do home brewing. Electronic steering is something that very few amateurs have used, simply because they don't understand it. Many an amateur has some understanding, has a lot of mystery in his mind as to what phase shift means. In other words, if I could feed both of your antennas that I'm speculating here, one that's north-south and one that's east-west, and you fed them both in phase, you'd get one pattern in space. Feed them out of phase, you'd get another pattern. Feed them with 90 degrees of delay to one, or 90 degrees of delay to the other, by way of an extra length of cable, a quarter wavelength of cable, will do electronic steering. And you can have an awful lot of fun with that, and it's not very expensive. So these are things to look forward to in my...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
These are things for you to look forward to, in my opinion, Howard. And as you do these experiments, with and without the grounding, with another antenna, and so on, please come back and tell us what you find. KC2, OJO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2EO, Dick.
N2EO, recognized. Let's pick up Howard first, and then we'll pick up Rich in that order. First, Howard, go ahead.
Dick, I definitely will try the grounding at the two different spots. The reason I'm using the NFED is because of a space requirement, basically, along one particular direction along my room. I have the power lines along the long direction of my property. So I decided that I would want to stay away from the power lines, and therefore I have just about that 66-foot run in one direction away. In fact, immediately suggested to me that perhaps with nothing in between, I could use the get a 40-meter in. And but I will definitely try grounding it at the antenna through the copper tape, and then removing the ground and trying it. It'll automatically be grounded at the shaft end anyway, because it's coming back on the coaxial cable. So really, I'm either going to have two grounds, or one, is the way I might look at it.
Yeah, let me ask you one other question, Howard, and that is, the power line that runs parallel to the longest dimension of your property, how far away is that power line? Is it really at your property line, or is it 20 feet away from your property in the adjacent easement property where the power company ran their power? If so, you have the option, in my opinion, of running an antenna parallel to the edge of your property or a little bit inside of it, even though it runs parallel to the power line. That's not necessarily bad. The power line itself is not a resonant structure, and it will not create any shielding in that direction, believe it or not. You'll be able to transmit right through it, so to speak. Make sure that all of the wire of your antennas are a good number of feet away from the power line, so that in the worst case situation, no contact between your antennas and that power line can take place. But how close to the edge of your property is that power line? Because don't throw away the possibility that you could run an antenna, let's say, 10 feet away from it, but parallel to it. Back to you, Howard.
Dick, the power line runs about directly over my fence line, directly at the edge of the property, and I only have between the room I'm in and the power line roughly about 30 feet, maybe a little bit more than 30 feet. And to make it worse, of course, the power line connection to my house is coming at right angles to that power line, and it's not far below the room that I'm in. So I decided to come out the face of the room that is away from the power line, and go in a direction that's parallel to the power line, it's roughly parallel, but in this case, I'm going to be going out about 40 feet away, 30 to 40 feet, I would say, parallel to the power line. I really don't have much room going at right angles, because I either come to the front of my property, where it might not look too good, or I encroach on the power line. Cases to OJO, over to Eagle.
Comment W2IGH. W2IGH recognized. You're going to be right after Rich in your comment. Okay, you're doing the right thing, Howard. You're doing it conservative, making sure that all of your antennas are far away from the LIPA or LOCO or Con Ed wiring. Smart thing to do. And you do have the ability, in my opinion, to also run the antenna to the front of the property. We amateurs immediately see wire and we see antennas. The rest of the population does not. You can prove this to yourself by taking all of the friends that have ever visited you at your house, and after they're inside your house, ask them, what do you believe is the color of the shingles on my house? And most of them will not be able to answer. They've never looked up in the air. Most people do not see wire. So you can string antennas even in the front of your property, up in the air, of course, and you will see them. Other people do not. Let's see what Rich has got to say, and then IGH after that. Rich, N2EL, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, N2EL. First of all, I agree with you 100%. People don't see wire. I have an inverted B-dipole that goes in front of my property, right out by the sidewalk, practically to the sidewalk, one end and the other end all the way to the backyard. Nobody has ever commented about it, like it's not even there. If he's going to run, I think you know, Dick, I'm a big proponent of open wireline, at least on the lower frequencies. If he's going to run either an inverted B-dipole, he'd be best off with open wireline and a tuner match all bands. A lot of people think open wireline radiates and it's going to give TDI because there's no shield. It's not true. What happens with open wireline, each side of the line is 180 degrees out of phase with the other side of the line. In other words, one side is pushing while the other side is pulling, so to speak. So there's cancellation on the line. Open wireline does not radiate. So he can use that if he puts whatever antenna he puts up to the lowest frequency would have to be a half wave. So if he's going to put up, say, a 40-meter dipole, it would work everything from 40 up to 10. An 80-meter would work everything from 80 up to 10 with the appropriate antenna tuner. So that's what I wanted to comment, Dick. A couple of other things I wanted to say. I was struck by lightning. I think you know that. About 3 years ago, I had an antenna on the peak of the roof, about 30 feet up. It blew into smithereens, wound up in a neighbor's tree. And what was left on the roof was a stub that was pristine critter. Fortunately, I had very little damage because I have extensive grounding. That's probably a little bit of luck. What I had damage to was the antenna tuner. It fried the switch, the switch in the tuner that switches, in, out, that sort of thing. It was a heavy ceramic wafer switch. It just fried completely. But the tuner was repairable. The other thing I wanted to comment, right, you mentioned Nick having the station upstairs or in the basement. Right now, we'll probably have no trouble. But years ago, I had the station upstairs. And when I ran a kilowatt upstairs in the bedroom, if the antenna is near the transmitter, some of the RF can get back into the transmitter and create problems in the audio stages with RF feedback. When I moved to the basement, that problem totally disappeared. can. But that may not be a case anymore. That was back with older equipment. Back to you, Nick. K2RIW N2EO.
Very fine, Rich, and thank you for the information. Rich, I wonder if you've changed microphones or rigs. Your audio sounds a little bit different, good and clear, but there's almost no bass notes to your audio. So have you made a recent change, Rich? Go ahead.
Just in some adjustments. When I set Collins up, I made some changes to the W2IHY 8-band equalizer. And, you know, I used one microphone for the whole shack with a switch. So I guess that's what you're hearing, Nick. It's clear, it sounds all right.
Very good copy, clear, sounds good, but there's no bass. In other words, you seem to have no frequencies below, I'm going to say, 400 hertz or so. No bass notes in there at all, and as such, it is a different sound than I've heard from you before, and I'm slowly getting used to it. Let's see what Hugo's got to say about all this. W2IGH, K2RIW. You got it, Hugo.
Okay, hello there, Nick. By the way,
listen
to you all the time, every Sunday. I don't check in, but I do listen to the thing very much. What I just wanted to mention is that your comment is quite, I agree with that. I have a D5 RV, where one leg runs north and south, and the other one is the west. So, and both of those are actually pretty much parallel to a power. They won't touch the power line. They're quite close to the power line. And it doesn't seem to be any different. So that's getting quite a very good result. So, as you said, probably because that's the problem. But I don't get any difference.
Very fine, Hugo. Glad to hear from you, and you want to check in a little more often. One problem, though, Hugo, your signal is a bit noisy and a bit weak. I'm wondering what you're using for an antenna or what you're using for a transmitter. I'm pretty sure it is not a handy-talkie because I heard no variation. I'm hearing you very nice and easily on the input. I think you're in Syosset. I'm hearing you very well out here in Huntington on the input. But through the machine tonight, you were a little bit noisy. I wonder what power you were running at. Hugo, go ahead.
Well, I am actually using the handy-talkie. I'm using the radio shack. Remember the 202? It's a rubber dock and I'm inside the house. So I don't bother to get it first thing. I have a better one to use the hot rod, I guess. And I do have a question, but I don't want to talk, you know, discussion about it. So when you get a chance, you might say it back to me, but it is radio chat.
Okay, we're willing to take your question right now, Hugo, but there's a catch. What I'd like you to do for me, since you are running a handy-talkie and rubber duck, maybe you're sitting down, could you do a brief walk across the room while transmitting and tell us what you're doing? In other words, you could count for us. This is step number one, step number two, step number three, and so on. I'm guessing that there's going to be a place in your room where you're going to sound a lot louder into the machine. What can easily happen, what happens to many people when they use a handy-talkie, is they'll move the handy-talkie horizontal, vertical, up, down, left, right, different places in the room, until they hear the repeater well. And they assume that because they're hearing the repeater well in that location, that the repeater is going to hear them well in that location. And if this is a simplex communication, that would be absolutely true. But because it is duplex, because you transmit on 2.5 and listen on 8.5, there's a different number of wavelengths between you and the transmitter and the repeater. on one frequency versus the other frequency. So therefore, when you find the right location for best reception, it might not be the best location for transmission. So do us a quick experiment if you can. Walk across the room and count where you are, or tell us, you know, I'm by the chair, I'm by the hall, or whatever, and that way we'll be able to find out where you sound the loudest. You are a bit scratchy into the machine right now. K2, it's correction, W2, IGH, K2RIW in the tech map.
Okay, Jake, I'm going to walk now.